Welcome back to the TV Talk Machine podcast. I am your co-host, Jason Snell, and across the internet from me, your host. His name's on the podcast, so he's really important. It's Chief TV Critic at The Hollywood Reporter, Tim Goodman. Hi.
Hello, Jason. Welcome back.
We missed a week.
We did miss a week.
We were bad. We were bad. We let everybody down by missing a week. Because, you know, you had your staycation / vacation.
I did.
And I had a bunch of different logistical stuff going on. And so we were trying to get our schedules to match up. And then there was a brief moment where it looked like they were all going to interact. You went to a Giants game. I went to a Giants game. And then all of a sudden, it all fell apart and there was no podcast. And
it really did. Yeah. It was like, we were like, okay, let's do it. And then let's do it. And then we were like, you know what? It's getting too late. We're not going to be able to do it.
It all went wrong. But that's okay, because we're back now. And
everybody lived.
In true podcast tradition, podcasts that missed an episode begin by apologizing about them missing a week of an episode. We did hear from some listeners on Twitter when we let them know that we weren't doing an episode last week, and somebody started the hashtag #SaveTVTM, which by my account, that is the only use of that hashtag, hoping that someone would pick us up as if we were canceled. And Dean, our longtime traveling listener, just hoped that Drop Bears were not involved
in our demise. No, it was just Drop Giants.
Listener Socrates said, I guess I'm going to have to spend my Saturday running from Drop Bears. So that was good, because he's he's in Melbourne, I want to say.
Yeah, he's living the dream in Australia.
Which is to stay alive, to be living in Australia. Anyway, so we're back. We got a little bit because you were on vacation. You haven't had a bunch of stuff posted anyway, so I don't know what we would have even talked about last week, but we should talk about it now. Arrested Development, Season 5. Now, you know, since there's a lot going on with Arrested Development, Season 5, which is out now. Mm-hmm. No, it's out next week.
29th, yes.
What a weird time.
Day to Tuesday. Drop it. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's not out yet. Out Tuesday. And of course, you wrote your review. You also know Jason Bateman a little bit. And so I think I have to ask, like, could this, felt to me like Netflix was really hoping, like, can we just slide this thing in there without having anything really blow up about Jeffrey Tambor? And that totally didn't happen.
That just didn't work. Yeah. It probably couldn't have gone any worse.
Nope. I had to laugh. There was a story about how they canceled their UK press tour, and they said Netflix said we hope to have them back at a later date. And somebody said, "What would the later date be? Like, it'll come out next Tuesday." And then, although I guess they are separating the season into two pieces,
Maybe they'll come back.
Maybe they'll come back. But yeah, it could not have gone worse for them. I think they were hoping that there would be like a little bit of a rumble about it, but they've spent enough time away from the stories about his behavior on the set of Transparent that they could get away with dropping this. And instead, what happened was, of course, if those of you who haven't read it, the New York Times had a nice setup where they had a bunch of cast members and they did an interview. It was all set up. I'm sure Netflix PR was really happy about that. And in the middle of it, not only did they directly address the stories about Jeffrey Tambor apparently being really unpleasantly bad toward Jessica Walter, but at several points in the middle of this, Jason Bateman and Tony Hale especially kind of tried to do the, I think they were just on the autopilot of like, let's defuse everything because we're doing a press tour. But the way it comes across in the interview is very much like right in front of a Jessica Walter saying, well, I'm sure he didn't mean it.
Yeah. Ouch. It was... Yeah, there was a lot of things that went clearly wrong in that part. To his credit, I think Jason he apologized. He said that was, you know, he mucked that up and owned up to it. I think his reasoning was, I mean, you can read his piece and see what you say. I think that the problem was Jessica Walter's really had a really terrible run-in with Tambor, and it hurt her, and she was in the room, and they were clearly they were not trying to, as Jason said in his follow-up thing, is the idea originally was, of course, not to, they weren't trying to belittle it. The thing that's lost in all of this, and I'm not saying that because I know Jason decently well, is that everybody wants to put on their best face when they come to these things. I'm sure they were very well aware that Tambor was going to get these questions that related mm-hmm. to his on-set behavior, not just on Transparent, but pretty much everywhere he's worked, there's right. been. But these guys love him. All the people, even Jessica Walters in the piece says, which is interesting, saying that, you know, she's forgiven him, and it helps for her to forgive him and not carry that weight of being so angry at him, which is, you know, it's destructive. You know, but she loves the show. Everybody loves the show. The question is, is everybody okay with
Jeffrey
Tambor's,
Tambor.
Yeah. Tambor's behavior? And they're not, but they were trying to talk. I think, you know, I'm certainly not going to get in the middle of it and try to explain something that I don't know because I wasn't there. I'm looking at what was setting the initial cringe inducing. This interview just went completely sideways. And then Jason's response, I think he was very clear about his response about what happened. I do think it's interesting, though. Everybody has a good point. Jessica Walter has this great point. But in defending Jessica Walter, but forgetting the end part where loves the show, she loves the role. She says she's born to do that role, wants to do that role until she's dead, basically. That's what she's saying. Everybody on the show loves their role. So all of them want the show to succeed and the show to go on. So I think it's a little, the idea that you wouldn't watch or you would boycott it because of either the interview or Tambor. Now, if you don't want to watch Jeffrey Tambor because of what his behavior and things that he's done, that's totally fine. As far as the New York Times interview goes and saying, I'm going to boycott it because of this thing, I don't think that Jessica Walter would really want you to do that. But, you know, everybody's got to make their own decision. And, you know, we covered it to death on THR, and there's not a need to put that stuff in the actual review of the actual show. What's going on outside of the show is a totally different thing. And people forget that this plays really, you know, if you looking back, you know, the last season of this was 5 years ago. So 5 years from now, if you're reading this and it's about, there's big swaths of paragraphs about Jessica Walter and Jeffrey Tambor, it's not going to make as much sense. You know, you can Google that story. We had 10 stories plus in THR. So that's why it wasn't in my review, but yeah, it's terrible timing, for the show, and the show's going to need all the help it can get, but I don't know if it's actually Jason in I don't know if it's in a position where it gets new followers anyway. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, we're talking about a show that's four seasons in and they're dropping season five. So it's, you know, it's got its audience that's found it on Netflix and the audience that watched it on TV. And that's about it. Yeah, it's funny that this came up in a, I do find myself asking, like, why did they make Jeffrey Tambor available to press at all? Like, why did Netflix put him in the room? Because I don't know the dynamic there and the politics of it, but like just having him not be present would have been one way to do it. And they were kind of asking for the reporter to ask the question with him present in the room and with Jessica Walter there. And, you know, it's kind of amazing because what you're seeing is the clash of phony PR setups with truth. And what I think the guys in that interview discovered is this is not a world where you can just hope to phony PR your way out of talking about somebody's abusive and potentially sexually harassing behavior. Like, you can't, that's not a card you should play. And that's, when I read that, that's how I read what they're doing. They're literally trying to just keep on spinning the, oh no, everything's fine, people should watch the show, we're here to promote the show. And you can't, as we have learned, you can't get away with that. That's not going to work. So, let's talk about the, oh no, go ahead.
Yeah, you're right. I think, I mean, when I looked at it, it's really interesting. It was two. Now, Tambor has actually, he did an extensive piece with THR sort of talking about his side and what was happening with Transparent. It's really interesting. You're right. I mean, when I learned he was there, I said, okay, so basically Jeffrey Tambor and his people believe that he's talked about his time on Transparent, and he's okay with everything, right? So, and whether that's, whether anybody else is okay with that is a totally different story. I think the Arrested Development people miscalculated in saying that, oh, well, since Jeffrey's been so open about saying, you know, I did bad things and, you know, and I did my big mea culpa with THR and all this stuff that were good, and no one will talk about, no one will talk about Transparent, and I'm good on this set. It stuns me that they would have him there, like you said, because he did say in the THR piece that he yelled at Jessica Walter, and they must not have done any pre-interviews with Jessica where she would have just told them, yeah, it was actually a very big deal to me, and it was very. I've moved past it, but I'm scarred by it. If you're a PR, if you're the head of PR or somewhere at Netflix, you're like, okay, you know, we pulled Jeffrey out of that because that's a mess. So none of that happened. And I can only imagine that they were thinking that Tambor's problems were related to a series that they don't have, you know. So they didn't clearly check with Jessica about how her feelings were. So that was the PR fault there. And
right,
you know, there you go.
Right, yeah, because it comes up, and because he mentioned it in THR, and she opens up about it and says. And this is part of the story, right? Is that everybody's trying to downplay it, and like, you know, people yell at people, other people. Right. And she's like, I've worked here for almost 60 years in the entertainment industry, and I have never been yelled at like I was yelled at by Jeffrey Tambor. And it's like,
yeah.
At some point you gotta get it. And to Alia Shawkat's credit, she's like on it right away. And
yeah.
And good for her for doing that, because it's like, no, do not downplay this. And really, it's Jessica Walter saying, I'm not going to let you downplay this. It was unacceptable behavior.
And she was crying. Yeah. Uh-huh. I mean, it's like, that was, they sort of botched that. And you know, the thing is, like, whatever piece that she makes with Jeffrey Tambor is her own business. But that doesn't mean fans will do that. And not only just fans of this, but fans of, you know, fans of
whatever, Transparent, Arrested Development,
Larry
Sanders.
Sure.
Max Headroom.
Can they watch it? Yeah.
My old classic favorite.
You're right. Yeah. So you just don't know. And, but as far as like the impact on the actual show, I think it's neither here nor there, because I don't think this is a series, just to circle back to the actual content. Mm-hmm. This is not a series that adds new. It's not a series that adds new viewers. I just can't see it. In fact, as I wrote in my review, the first couple of episodes are, unfortunately, they're troubling, you know, not from the, you know, actor standpoint, but from season four was their, you know, it's universally considered it was not good. Most of that was structural. I tried to put some history in there because I don't think some people knew what Mitch Hurwitz was trying to do with that series.
How do we make an ensemble show where the people literally can't be together?
They can't be together. And I think the less told story about that season, honestly, was that Netflix was very new. It's not the Netflix we know now. And for whatever reason, when they were talking to Hurwitz about the possibilities in the new streaming environment, remember, you know, it's weird. The world flips over on its head and no one can ever remember how it once was. Mm. You know, people don't remember putting actual phones on their ear, like, you know, landline phones anymore, that the feel of what that big ear cup was. So like, we just forget institutionally, memorably, we forget. So people forget that in the TV business, like the concept of streaming, it's crazy. Why would you put them all out on the same day and not let out, you know, every other week or every week? And I think what happened when they talked to Mitch about it, he's a creative guy, and he was like, oh, like people can watch them out of order and they can come in whenever they want and revisit certain episodes. And he thought, oh, if you're going to come in and out of it, I'll make this Rashomon style series, which, you know, he later regretted. And Netflix is pretty new at the time too. And they barely had any shows.
It was one of the first three or four shows.
Yeah. I mean, if you go back, they had like two or three. This might have been the third or fourth show. So I'm not going to say they didn't know what they were doing, but I'm sure they were like, oh yeah, absolutely, can make it in any order. And he put a lot of effort into it. It was, as he will tell you, it was in the words of of Job. It was a huge mistake. and it kind of ruined season four for people. I make the point that I think there were lots of parts of season four that were very funny. Jokes were very, very funny in there, but it's lost in this narrative about the structure. And unfortunately for season five, the first two episodes are basically completely saddled with explaining story arc from 5 years ago, because unlike most sitcoms, it's on a linear storyline that it's picking back up from season four. You can call that a mistake. They should maybe just reinvented the show. Who knows? But boy, those first two seasons are the first two episodes. They're mind-numbingly confusing.
Yeah. So they got to spend time unwinding before they can move forward. So after that is all said and done. I mean, I guess you got to see the first seven.
Yeah. And there's only going to be eight. There's 16 episodes total. They're dropping the first eight on the 29th. And then I'm not sure after that when the next eight come, but they showed us the first seven, and then they promised that they would put the eighth in there soon. But most of the reviews have already been written, so it's kind of pointless. So I saw seven. The first two are, oh my God, are they confusing? It's so much exposition, and I mean, I was laughing at that, so much work that Ron Howard was doing to explain things. There is still a couple of funny jokes in there, but it doesn't actually start clicking and making sense until the third episode. This is why if you're not a Die Hard fan, you are absolutely done and out at that point. But once it gets going, I started to get a whole lot more laughs. And by the fifth episode, five, six, and seven, it feels like the first three seasons on Fox. It feels like normal again. So, you know,
you just got to get there.
It's just a caveat to people, but I don't think that affects... I mean, sure, someone somewhere is going to say, oh, I heard about Arrested Development and all this news, and they put it on, and they're going to not, you know, what the hell is going on, and they're going to turn it off. But everybody else who's a diehard, they're going to have to, unfortunately, suffer through that first couple of episodes, and then it'll be good again. But it is what it is. You can't get past that. I love it, especially from, like, 5, 6, 7. Those are really good episodes. Some of the callbacks are very, very funny. The comic time, Bateman's comic timing has not been lost at all. Some of the jokes are that go way back are great. It's great to see Barry Zucker Korn back make an appearance again. There's some surprise cameos, and I want to see what the second half looks like too. But I was happy with it.
All right. What about the other piece you wrote for THR in the last fortnight, which was 10 superbly written TV series? Interesting angle, like playing up the writing. I think that is it a challenge to kind of unwind the writing versus other aspects of what makes a TV show great?
Yeah, it was. And it was, I kind of struggled with it because I didn't, it ended up being a list of 10, and I didn't actually even try to make it 10. I kind of laughed at the end when it was 10. And I knew that I was going to have an upcoming power rankings, and I didn't want to make it that. But I just, and there are more than 10 excellently written television shows out there, including the one you and I both really like, which is Counterpart. I think that is... Not only is it structured so well, but it's written so well. I think David Simon did such a great job with Deuce. But that I said, you cannot let me just take away the shows that only spent one season. Because, part of the writing is a part of television is show me what have you done for me lately? You have to continue your greatness. So I needed shows that had at least had two episodes. And then once I picked those shows, I was like, OK, what are the ones that instantly come to mind as when I watch them? I know they are exceptionally well written. Some of them are even, but not all of them, exceptionally well structured in the plotting. And then what are the ones where it's just a joy to hear the dialogue, Veep being one of them. I can watch that show with my eyes closed. And, on others, when I'm watching it and I realize, man, these actors have so much great material to work with. Some actors can make not very good material become great material. But in these series, I find that these actors are probably just thinking, I can't wait. I'm so lucky to play this role. I'm thinking of the A word specifically. So it was a little difficult to pick out 10. I tried to have the caveat like saying, hey, everybody, this is not a definitive list. It doesn't end at 10. But these are on my mind right now as shows where every time I watch this show, I'm like, the success of this show is distinctly coming from the writer's room.
Okay, so let's run them down. The Americans, shocker.
Right. Yeah. That's the Mount Rushmore show. Yeah. If you ask me.
Better Call Saul, which you point out, you know, is also extending the legacy of Breaking Bad, which is extra hard to do. So
yeah, and maybe that's the hardest thing that they had to do, right? Get out from underneath the shadow.
Right. Right. Fargo. There's your Noah Hawley appearance. I'm not surprised. I think Legion is an example of a show that's very well written, but it is so much relying on its visuals in a way that it would be in your list of the visually brilliant series, I'm sure.
Absolutely. And I think if you look at it, and this is kind of wonky and I won't go down that rabbit hole too much, but I think you would agree that Noah Hawley is such a good writer that I think what intrigues him about a Legion is that he comes up with these scenarios, he puts the characters in them, and then he sort of takes the dialogue where it will go. You know, you can have all the characters sort of reacting to the trippy things they're witnessing. A lot of the humor comes from their reactions to things that are mind blowing. Whereas in Fargo, it is literally all on the page. And there are scenes, I've talked to people who said, oh, the third season of Fargo is the weakest. Whatever your take on that is fine, but I would say the third season, it's so illustrative of how two actors get in a room and take Noah Hawley's dialogue and just go back and forth with it, and you can tell they are just giggling. They're just like, oh my god, this is so great, because the nuance is in every word. It's in the structure. It's in the word choices. There might not be another series on this list where every single word matters so much.
I smiled when I saw Veep on the list, and you mentioned Armando Iannucci, who is not on the last couple of years of it, but was the creator of it. And there is so much good writing on that show, and it's so smart. And Iannucci is such a talented writer, and was in the previous series that led into Veep and all of that. So I was happy to see that as a comedy on the list.
Oh yeah, he's genius, and you know, credit to David Mandel and his staff of writers and many of them were still the same writers, but David Mandel's super funny. He's from Curb and many other things, but that's just everybody there. Again, that's a show I try to point out. Like, you could turn, I could close my eyes, and I don't have to see anybody's face, and I'll laugh because the jokes are so good. Mm-hmm.
We should mention you've got a Power Rankings for comedy coming up too.
Next Monday should be out. Yeah, it's long overdue.
And then we'll talk about it. You put Game of Thrones on the list. I thought that was interesting. I like what you said here, which is that think of the structure and all of the world building that happens, and yet also having it be truly, dramatic, and having dealing with all the different story threads and keeping it all moving forward. It's high degree of difficulty for a show like that.
Oh, there's so much, plate spinning. At the same time, David Benioff and D.B. Weiss, I didn't want to belittle their efforts in dialogue by saying, oh my god, it's the structure, because it really is. The structure is amazing, but they're not just architects of a story structure. They're the writers too. And I tried to point out that we take for granted how hard it is to do that sort of British royal monarchy acting that was so popular on BBC and PBS, and then place it in a fantasy element where you do kind of have kings and queens and people, and they're all speaking in this basically BBC, PBS language. It's a little harder to make it believable when you're not really the queen. You are a dragon slayer, or it's hard to have the highbrow with the fantasy element and make that work. That people, they don't get enough credit for that. And also the fact that a lot of the costume dramas on PBS and BBC that I do love dearly, it's a little bit of eat your vegetables, and there's no eat your vegetables to Game of Thrones. It's nonstop entertainment.
Some more comedies on the list making me smile. You're the Worst, so good to do. Mm-hmm. So hard to mix the serious stuff, the dark stuff, in while also keeping it just solidly funny, which is what You're the Worst does.
Yeah, and they probably could have, I think you might agree, they could have kept that first season's kind of just, debauchery going.
They could have.
And then they could have. And they just, because that's what a regular sitcom would have done. And they decided to make it a little more serious, a little darker. And I think Stephen Falk deserves lots of credit for that.
And you also mentioned Brooklyn Nine-Nine, which that is a... not only do they sometimes cover difficult and controversial topics and try to do it, but they're always funny. It's just like, it's always funny. The characters are solid. It's got a great cast. It's got a great diverse set of characters. And yet, you know, for all of the things about it that are great, we can't lose sight of the fact that it's just an amazing comedy machine. Like, it just keeps it's like a cannon just firing out jokes endlessly. Yes. It blows me away.
And great jokes. And it's funny because I did this for, you know, this came out this week, and I have Bob's Burgers on there, and I have basically the same, I think you would probably agree, it was same thing to say about Bob's Burgers.
Yeah, same about Bob's Burgers. Mm-hmm. It is startling that that Bob's Burgers just, I mean, it's endlessly funny. Just amazing stuff.
And the thing I tried to point out, Jason, on both of those, and I think you and I, since we talk about TV, we have a real appreciation for this, even though we do a lot of more cable and higher brow fare, is like, man, when you're churning out multiple episodes for a broadcast network, and your batting average on jokes in play is so high for Brooklyn Nine-Nine and Bob's Burgers, that's a sign of a really strong cast, a really good showrunner with a vision, a creator. And you can't say enough about how hard that is to do week in and week out without like mailing it in, or worse, having two or three episodes in a row where it's kind of like mildly amusing. I think that both of those shows are never just mildly amusing. I think they're always have at least a handful of very, very funny jokes in them.
I also, for fans of comedy sabermetrics, you just heard a reference to Bajip. Batting average on jokes in play. It's a new statistic.
Wow. I think we might have a title of our news episode.
I don't know what's going on there.
People will be like, what is that acronym for?
The A word and better things are the round out your list. Both... I don't even know how to say both of them, kind of indelibly their own thing. Like, you wouldn't mistake them for something else.
No, and also, it's, you know, the human condition, you know, on Better Things, you have a very feminist take. You have basically what it's like to be a mom and daughter, because she has a mom. She's got three daughters. It's Pamela Adlon's take. And I left Louis C.K. in there. People are, of course, mad at him, as many people in the doing bad things in the Me Too movement. But he has written a great deal of the episodes of Better Things. And what he writes on the paper, as opposed to maybe how he acts in public, are two different things. His writing is excellent. And they have put together a series where the nuances of this slice of life of what if this single mom raising these kids and dealing with her own mother, but also dealing with her own life and career and her sense of her own sexuality and her dreams and, you know, being tired. It's such a great perspective. The writing nails that. Because I think it's well acted, but the writing really drives it. And then the A word, obviously I tout this all the time. It's one of my favorite series, but, Peter Boker has captured this world, where there's a child with autism, and what does it mean? Not just for the child, for Joe, the kid at the center of this, but their parents who just discover in the first season, he has it and they don't really know what it is. And they're trying to deal with it. How does it affect their marriage? That could just be the show, but that's not the show. It's also what is life like in a small village where people rally around a family like that or ignore a family like that. And nothing goes missed in a small English village. And the location is, as I've said many times, is central to the success of this story, since Joe does walk around quite a bit on his own. And the music is great. It's just, I don't think you'll see, there's been other series written about autism, but I don't think you'll find a better written series, certainly about autism, but a better series about sort of like what you have a special needs kid and what is it like for everybody, not just the family, but the grandparents and the friends and the village. It's beautifully written.
All right. Before we do some letters, I wanted to at least mention one piece of news, because I was wondering if you were talking about, since we're talking about people that you played fantasy sports leagues with, should we mention that Keith Olbermann is like going full in to his role at ESPN? Apparently, this was a story I saw today on the Hollywood Reporter.com. Yeah. He's going to guest anchor like 20 episodes of Sports Center, and he's going to do some play-by-play of baseball games and a whole bunch of other stuff. What a funny thing. I would never have predicted that Keith Olbermann would boomerang all the way back to ESPN, but it sounds like maybe he's changed, maybe the people who are at ESPN have changed, maybe they found the right way to use him. I don't even know, but it is funny that they tried him out like as a little sampler for the last 5 months, and now they've like inked him to a bigger deal to expand his role. It's kind of interesting.
It is really interesting. I don't think I have to say that, because I really like Keith, and he's great at what he does, and he's politically people are going to either like him or not like him, but he's to me, you know, that original Sports Center where he and Dan Patrick made it a thing, well, that'll go down in history as one of the greatest pairings of all time. But I want the deal that he got, because you really got to love the fact that he's a polymath, and he loves everything and is smart about lots of things. He was a 16-year-old kid when he was at Cornell, and he's a brainiac, and his interests don't just run to one thing. And so I love this gig where he's doing outside the lines, he's calling baseball games, he's doing some Sports Center, he's kind of all over the map. Yeah. I looked at that and I was like, now that's a fun job, because it's 15 jobs. That's nice.
Yeah. All right, you want to do some quick letters?
I do.
All right, they've built up over the fortnight.
Okay.
Lauren from the 306 says, when shows are canceled and brought back, like Brooklyn Nine-Nine, do the actors feel relief, even though it's a shorter season, going from 22 to 13, I think, for Brooklyn Nine-Nine? Are they down about the loss of pay for fewer episodes? Are they more likely to look elsewhere for a paycheck, thus precipitating the show's demise? Yeah, any read on this? Are they when you're coming back, but you're coming back for half the episodes, presumably they have a per episode fee, so they're going to get half the money, although it does mean they're going to work half the time too.
Yeah, I think for this show in particular, everybody's happy to come back. They didn't want it to end. I think everybody loves that working on that show. I think it's a pretty good family environment from what I understand there. They're good people. It's good showrunners. And, you know, they're all at their own level of fame. Some of them, right when they came into it, you know, Sandberg and you know, there's a number of people who are already doing strong work. For everybody else, they're getting more chances at doing things in the off season, and they'll have quote unquote off season. There's another baseball reference or sports reference, but they'll have more time to do that. Is exactly what you said. I don't think at this point, how many seasons they've been doing it, I don't think the money is a matter. They're not all super, super rich. They're richer than we are, but I think they're happy to keep doing the show they want, and they'll have time to do other things.
Yeah. Well, they all got paid a lot for all those seasons. Now they're going to take a pay cut in that sense. But yeah, if you do any other work in this business, whether it's on movies or TV or doing stand-up comedy or whatever, like I get the impression that American TV with 22 episodes and all that is a real grind, and that
it is.
That they don't mind not working that much because there are other things that they can do. They can either go on vacations with their family, or they can do a play, or they can say yes to that movie role. And I think that that's why you're seeing more actors who are well-known do TV, because the commitment isn't as big. And like, I'm sure Kristen Bell is very happy, and Ted Danson and everybody else in that cast, that The Good Place is just, it's a 13-episode show. So
yeah,
they'll do 13 episodes a year, and the rest of the time they're just off. They can be in movies, they can do other stuff, and that's my guess. And now if you're somebody who's essentially unemployable outside of Brooklyn Nine-Nine, then they might feel differently about that. But
yeah.
My understanding too is that, you know, Mike Schur's got his deal with Universal to do these shows, and he's got another show that I think I picked up for the fall. So even the crew and stuff may find there may be some synergy there between the crews of these shows, where they kind of jump from one of these to the other and keep being employed. So
yeah.
So I think it's okay, Lauren. I think it's okay. Our friend the MVP wrote in,
yes,
my Vogue on Poetry, to say, mm-hmm. How important is market research in the era of peak TV? I think the new HBO drama Succession looks incredibly bad, and Lord of the Rings on Amazon will fail miserably. Did they make it past focus groups, or are big wigs just calling shots? Well, Lord of the Rings is literally Jeff Bezos saying, yeah, sign that, make that deal. There's nothing to see. I think they've, I think they've announced that it's going to be, I think there's a story about how it's, where it's going to be set. And it's going to be like young, Viggo Mortensen from the movies, basically, you know, back when he was younger and just kind of a green, starting out, hero, beardy hero guy. But,
I'm going to watch the heck out of all those. So I don't think it's going to fail. I think there's a built-in audience
I think it's, going to be a success. I really do. But let's take the more general point, which is in this PTV era, outlets doing market research? Are they taking pilots and showing them to, you know, tired people in Las Vegas and having them fill out forms or whatever they used to be, or streaming them on an internet site somewhere where people say if they like them or not before they decide to go to series? Or is that just that over?
I think networks are definitely doing it. I'm not so sure cable channels are doing it as much as they used to be. Maybe you know, maybe they do that, but I'm thinking at some point maybe TNT and TBS are still doing that, but I don't think a lot of cable ones are doing that anymore. I mean, make those decisions inside about whether something works or doesn't work. So yeah, and you know, I think even Amazon, which used to have the pretense of think
pilot season,
I think they're kind of giving that up.
Internet polls. My theory about the pilot season was that they were looking at the numbers of who watched the pilots, but not what they voted, just the numbers. That was my theory. I think we've talked about like Apple getting into this business too. So many deals now, way more than ever used to be, are made as series commitments.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, you know, we look at your scripts and we give you a series commitment. And then at that point, they're just going to make the show and we'll see how it goes. And they can give notes as they go. But like, it really is like they're all in. And Apple, all of Apple's buys are all in. So you can't market research it because you're not going to find like generic viewer and have them read a screenplay and imagine, right? It's not going to happen. So this is, I think there's a lot less of that now.
Network side.
Heard a nice thing from Ben in the +61. So Australia, we always have letters from Australia. Ben points out Counterpart has a home now in Australia. It starts next month. So that was a good piece of information. I also, somebody sent me, and I don't know exactly who it was, sent me a note that they announced that in the UK, they're doing, and Germany, they're launching Stars Play as a streaming service inside Amazon channels, and Counterpart should be on the Stars Play list of shows. So that's going to be your official UK way of getting Counterpart, and presumably a bunch of the other Stars programming, is that they're setting up their own Stars streaming service inside of Amazon channels. So you buy it and it just shows up in your Amazon app as one of the streams of content. So some more information about that. And there was also we also had a Counterpart note from Marina, a longtime letter writer from the 734, who wrote in and said, I purchased Counterpart on iTunes. It's now available on iTunes. If you want to watch it and you don't have Stars, you can just buy the season on iTunes. I watched a couple of episodes before bed last night. At 3 a.m., my normally aloof and independent dachshund woke me up, apparently afraid of the thunderstorm. It's such unusual behavior for her that, as I calmed and comforted her in my sleepy haze, I thought, in all seriousness, this isn't something my dog would do. This must be Peggy Prime. Needless to say, I blame TVTM. Thank you, Marina. Since that's not my dog, that is an opposite dog. It's a counter dog, something like that. Counter dog, we'll work on it. Something like that. Counter pet. Yeah, there it was right there.
Counter pet
is the answer. I can't believe I didn't get there. All right. Well,
wow. You got there.
Luke. Oh, back to Australia for a moment. Listener Luke wrote in to say a funny thing. Arrested Development can't be shown in Netflix on Australia. They don't have the rights to their own show. A local competitor does. It sounds to me like maybe there was, apparently this happens a lot in Australia where the streaming service landscape is totally messed up because there are all these different services, and some of them, it seems like sprung out of channels that that made their own streaming service. And they have, in this case, I don't know, but my guess is that they had some sort of Fox licensing agreement for Arrested Development that extended beyond the life of the show. And so when Australia and Netflix can't show it, they were like, no, that we get that. We'll buy that. That's ours. So I read that. It's a great story. I'll put a link in the show notes. It's amazing. Basically, my apologies and condolences to our friends in Australia. It sounds like streaming down there is a real mess. Like it'll get worked. I think it's all going to get worked out eventually. All these contracts will lapse at various points, and everybody's going to realize that international play is the way to go. You got to do what the TVTM does. They're going to look to us and say, oh yeah, simultaneous worldwide release in all markets. That's the way to do it. And they'll get there, but they're not there.
So what you're saying basically though, is that streaming in Australia is also very dangerous.
Yeah, it is.
It's not easy.
Be careful, right? Because you might stream a spider.
Yeah.
You might stream a drop bear.
Everything is difficult in that world.
Yeah, you might stream a shark. It's possible. That's why the animals are so poisonous. They can't figure out what's on Netflix
mad.
And what's not.
They're angry.
Mm-hmm. Donnie in the 206 wrote in and said, in regards to the cancellation of The Expanse, I think one issue is that its U.S. streaming rights went to Amazon. While we've seen shows like Breaking Bad and Riverdale get a huge Netflix bump in live ratings after debuting on Netflix, the same can't be said for shows that land in the Amazon graveyard. Wow. I can't help but feel that that amazing shows like Mr. Robot, Hannibal, and The Americans would be more popular if they were on Netflix. It's at the point now where if I see my favorite low-rated show end up on Amazon, I know it's either doomed or destined to live in obscurity. Love to your mothers, Donnie in the 206. What do you think? Donnie's basically taking it to Amazon and saying that Netflix is a lifeline for shows because it exposes them to so many people. And if they go on Amazon, people don't know they exist. What do you think?
I'm certainly part of that. It's definitely true. There's a bigger audience on Netflix. I wouldn't say that's the end. People do get Amazon. I'm not going to defend his question. I mean, like, or oppose it, because I've certainly written things that have totally agreed with it. I would just say that any exposure is good exposure for some of these sure. shows to go on.
But Netflix is a bigger billboard than Amazon Prime Video is.
And Hulu too, you know, and Hulu's even bigger, but you know, you kind of want to have, I think you know, there was a story that the THR did that, Jeff Bezos is a huge fan of The Expanse, and they want to continue it on Amazon. Nothing is written. No deal is signed yet.
Right.
But I think the reason that no deal is signed yet is that, you know, as we said, the production people for Expanse, they're self-funding it. They kind of own it. And outright ownership is not a thing that works anymore. And if someone's going to come along and save you, like Amazon, you're going to have to give up part of your profits.
Right. There might be a co-production kind of deal going on. That's possible.
And that's not easy to hammer at, because basically you're saying to somebody, I know you made a lot of money on this for the first three seasons, but you're either dead or you're going to give us a bunch of money and then we'll keep it going. And I'm hoping cooler heads will prevail and they'll stay on Amazon.
Yeah. And that is the rumor that they're talking to Amazon. And my thought too was that, the negotiations are probably complicated. It might involve an ownership stake. I was also thinking it also might be a negotiation over what they buy. Like maybe they're talking about, do you pick it up for 20 episodes instead of 10? Sci-fi has been doing 10 at a time. Do you pick it up for 10 or 15 or 20, two seasons? Maybe that's part of the conversation too. It's like, you want to invest in this. Maybe if I was at Alcon, the owners of this, I'd be like, well, you know, we want you to save. That's great. But you know, what would be even greater is if you saved it and also gave it a commitment for a couple of years so that we'd save a little bit of money here or there. We'll cut you in for a piece. And I don't know. It is good news. I am hopeful that story means that it will be saved, even though it's all just kind of preliminary. There were some initial reports that said it was saved, and that is not true. They're like, they're talking, but
they're talking.
It sounds like they want to get it done. It's just a matter of the details. But like we said, the reason it got canceled is complicated because of the details, because of who has what streaming rights, and Universal had their linear rights, and Amazon had the U.S. streaming, and Netflix had rest of world streaming, and it's a mess. So hopefully they'll untangle it and that show will survive, because it's fun. I like it a lot.
Yeah. And I wanted to, I just want two quick clarifications. about Amazon certainly being the graveyard, as the suggestion was. The problem with Amazon is getting the actual. So for example, and these totals shift monthly, and this is, and this data is a little bit old, but you know, Netflix has 55 something million domestic subscribers and 63 million international, and put that together, they're by far the biggest leader. And everybody who gets Netflix, no matter where they are, domestic or international, is buying it for the content. Now, Amazon has about 90 million domestic subscribers. The question is, how many of them just want the 2 days free shipping? And how many of them are buying it just for the shows? Slash, how many people are paying for it and don't know they're getting video access to? That's the big question, right, with them. But they're still much bigger. I think Hulu's 17 or 18. It all increases every month. But yeah, Amazon's number two right now. But the question is, the numbers are large, but are the viewers large?
Right. Yeah. I do think there's something to Donnie's point, though, that if you're a show that desperately wants to be discovered so that you can survive, you know, you're going to more likely be discovered on Netflix because there are more people, there are more eyeballs on Netflix, the bottom line.
Yeah, no doubt.
Chris from the 216, and as many people do, giving us their whole history, forced into the 440 20 years ago. Still bitter.
Love it.
Chris is still bitter.
Love it.
Says, I watch everything on DVR and just assumed Brooklyn Nine-Nine was on NBC. It seems so NBC-ish. I can see it on the same fall schedule as shows like 30 Rock and Parks and Rec. It has an SNL spinoff feel to it. When I think Fox, I think of things like Family Guy, The Simpsons, New Girl, or Married with Children. I guess that goes to show you can't always tell where a show aired by the way it feels. The networks have become less and less important over the years. I think there's something to this, right? Like sometimes shows feel weird. Like Brooklyn Nine-Nine was made for NBC and NBC passed on it. And that's why it feels like an NBC show, kind of, is it was supposed to be and they didn't want it. And Fox took it because Fox liked it, which is great because otherwise we wouldn't have seen it. But it was not intended to be, just as Kimmy Schmidt was not intended to be a Netflix show. It was intended to be an NBC show and they passed on that one too.
Exactly.
So that's why it feels like that. And every now and then you talked about how there was that period where Fox decided it was going to be CBS. And that was really weird. And it didn't go well. And now it's not that. And there was even that period way back when CBS thought it might be Fox. That also was a mistake.
That was bad.
Don't do it. All right. Last item is from TPM in the 425, who said, a TV at my gym this weekend was showing, quote, professional, close quote, cornhole. I think we've reached peak TV. You know, TPM, I enjoy cornhole. Let me list where I like playing cornhole. I like playing cornhole before a football game. I like playing it out in a field on a vacation, maybe when I'm camping, maybe even in the summer on a warm day in the backyard with some beer and friends and maybe kids. Here's what I don't want to see. And I watch curling on television. I watch televised curling. I don't need to see cornhole professionals playing corn, tossing bean bags on television somewhere. So yes, I think this is, Tim, what do you think? The proof that we are at peak TV.
it's clearly too much. Yeah.
This far and no further. You've crossed the line, television. Go back.
Go back.
Professional cornhole. We got to call it there. Either that or we're sending the Drop Bears. Something like that. I brought it back around
Turn
to Australia.
Around.
Where are the Drop Bears? What service are the Drop Bears on, Tim? Are they on Netflix in Australia? No, turns out they're not. You'd think, but they're not. They're on some other weird service. All right. Here's how you can send your messages from Australia and other places to us. You can email us podcast at tvtalkmachine.com or just tweet at us at TVTM, because Twitter lets you write like 80,000 words in a tweet now. So you could do that. And we will be back next week. And if we aren't, we're a bunch of rotten liars. But the plan is we will be back next week for more. But until then, Tim, it's been a pleasure as always.
Jason, it can't be any more pleasurable. Bye, everybody.
Bye, everybody.